This panel discussion on HIV/AIDS took place on the 30th of April 2014 at the New Zealand Film Archive in Wellington.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Carl Greenwood. Carl is the chair for this evening. Carl has worked for many years in HIV/AIDS in that area, and currently the general manager at the Drugs and Health Development Project, and prior to that was at the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. So Carl is going to introduce our wonderful panel.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks for organising tonight. And yes, I'm Carl Greenwood, and Drugs, Health and Development Project, I run the five needle exchanges in the lower half of the North Island, so still in the prevention area for HIV, but more around Hep C for the community I work for now. New Zealand's done a really good example of actually if you tackle a problem at the beginning, you can actually make some good inroads. So in 1987, they changed the law to allow needle and syringe regulations, and the first needle exchange opened in 1988 in Palmerston North, and luckily we've been able to get the message out, and people generally in New Zealand don't share needles, and we've managed to keep HIV out of the community, even though Hep C's huge. And also I've lived with HIV for 25 years, so I sort of have a pretty wide knowledge of just personally of the virus and how it has affected our communities. Anyway, I'll let the panel introduce themselves. We'll start with Ron.
Hi everyone, I'm Ron Irvine. I'm the manager of Body Positive Wellington. We've been going now since July 15th last year, and previous to that I was in Auckland at the Body Positive Centre there. We're an organisation that looks after people living with HIV. We advocate for them, and we run a number of services for those people. Do a little bit of testing as well, and counselling, that sort of thing. So it is a drop-in centre, so people can drop in and gain information and gain services from us.
I'm Vaughan Meneses. I've been from the New Zealand AIDS, well, I'm on the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. I've been on the Trust Board there since November 2011. I've been involved with the Foundation and its work since sort of late 1986, so I've got a bit of a history and experience around this issue. I'm also an HIV positive, so I bring that sort of viewpoint to the board in its current position, which is extremely invaluable. And yeah, so I guess I was a late bloomer to HIV, like most of us. We all know how to prevent it, but it doesn't mean we always take the advice. So it wasn't until the 15th of May 2004 that I contracted the virus from a person who actually knew they had the virus. I didn't know that at the time, but it was my choice to have unsafe sex with them at the time with my partner after a night out drinking and a few drugs involved. So it just goes to show that even you can know everything, but it doesn't necessarily mean you behave particularly well all the time. So yeah, that's my experience, and I'm hoping to sort of contribute positively to tonight's conversation.
Hi, my name is Jane Bruning. I'm the national coordinator for an organisation called Positive Women. We provide support for women and families in New Zealand living with HIV or AIDS. And that covers lots of things. We do advocacy, and we also do educational programs. And basically support. But I've also been living with HIV for 26 years now. We've got quite an experienced panel here on HIV. Thank you.
A tēnā koutou katoa, nā mehinue ki a koutou, kua tai mai nei, ki te tēnei rōpū, whakawhiti kōrero mō tēnei pō, nō reira tēnei te mihi ki a koutou. Just see my auntie walk in the room. Kia ora, auntie, for coming. Kia ora. Yes, my name is Marama Pala, and I just realised, you guys are in Mairohe. This is where I come from. I'm Te Atiawa ki Pona ki Waikanae, so I'm supposed to be welcoming you guys. So haere mai. Haere mai, haere mai. But currently I work and live in the Waikato, but definitely my whānau are from here. My mahi is in an organisation called ENA, which is for Māori, Indigenous and South Pacific, and it's a foundation. But it seemed, I have a lot of hats there, and one of them is the co-chair of the International Indigenous Working Group on HIV and AIDS, which is international, has 11 countries. And I'm also a board of director member of ICASO, which is the International Council of AIDS Organisations, based in Toronto. So there's my three hats. But I also, our organisation does the same things as Body Positive and Positive Woman, with a bit of a Māori twist, and we do a lot of whānau ora. Mō reira, tēnā koutou
katoa. Thanks very much. Hi, I'm Nigel Raymond. I'm an infectious disease physician at Wellington Hospital, and so as well as HIV, work in other general infectious disease areas and also in general medicine. I started off when I was doing my registrar training in Christchurch in the 1980s when folks started to turn from the States to New Zealand and then worked in Waikato, where it was in Auckland, and Auckland, and worked in Atlanta in the States in the beginning of the 1990s, 4 years, when there was a lot of sort of AIDS era. And then I've been back in Wellington since 1996, so just over 4 years. So we have a relatively small department in Wellington Hospital with two other part-time ID physicians, as well as myself and James at the back there, who's probably the crux of our service, with and others who are involved in help as well. So there are about 300 people that would follow through the service. A pleasure to be here, thank you, and I'm looking forward to learning from other people as well.
Thank you, panel. That was great. So tonight we've decided to split this into four sections. We're going to do a segment on stigma, media, support and education, and wellness. Stigma, eh? It's probably one of the most difficult things we have to deal with as positive people. It's absolutely rife. And I'm going to pass it over to the panel to comment on stigma. I imagine you've all got stories or examples. I certainly have.
You've got
the talking stick.
Yeah.
Stigma, yeah. Just like the gentleman there in the hospital, my ex-partner had a similar situation in Auckland Hospital, and that was probably 15 years ago. It was a really tough time because, people would come in and say, why do we have to put gowns on? And I remember there was a little red dot. And if there was a red dot on your name tag, that meant that you were HIV positive. And again, that was putting us into something that, if people knew about that, it would identify us. And we've certainly come a long way since those times, for sure. But I think we've really got a long way to go. Mm.
I've got a couple. I've always got a yarn to tell. No, actually, these are back in the 90s. I had a car accident between Martin and Balls. You guys know where Martin and Balls is? Yeah, I had a car accident on the side of the road there, and I was actually pinned into the car, and they had to cut me out of the car. And I actually didn't have any injuries on me at all. I had a bit of glass in my ear and a couple of scratches and glass in my hair. And they rushed me off to I shouldn't say the hospital, but Whanganui Hospital. And there was someone else in the car with me, and they basically got x-rayed, were out waiting for me 6 hours later, and I couldn't understand why it took so long for them to process me and put me through the x-ray, you know, x-ray me so I could at least get up off the table. And I actually was perfectly fine. My head had gone through the side window of the car. But anyway, I found out afterwards that they didn't want me to be on their brand new x-ray machine in case I bled on it. So they were waiting for one in storage to be pulled out and put in a back room so they could take me down to the old one, because it didn't matter if I bled on that one. And I remember thinking afterwards, I'm thinking, well, I'm sure they can wash it. And thinking, and it just, it's always stayed with me, that sort of stigma. And things have changed a lot since then. I've got a doctor next to me. Things have changed a hell of a lot since then. But I must say, even in the system, in some of the hospitals today, you still, it depends who you get. I mean, of course, our HIV specialists and people that are working with it day to day know what's going on. It's the ones that don't know what's going on where you get the stigma and discrimination. And I suppose the only other sort of story that popped in my mind that happened again in the 90s, well, actually, no, it was 2001. I was teaching kapahaka at a high school, and it was just a 2 days a week type thing, going in and teaching a bunch of kids some songs and poi and things like that. And they knew that I had one of the parents knew I had HIV. And next thing you know, there was this huge sort of activism to getting rid of me, getting me off the school grounds and stopping me from teaching these children, as if I was somehow going to pass the virus on to them by teaching it. It was kind of a really sort of situation that stood out to me in the early 2000s. So it's still out there.
Yeah, definitely. It was only 2 years ago I went in to get a blood test, and the nurse came in and looked at my form, and actually I could see her freaking out, and she put the form down and left the room. And she came back about 5 minutes later and put on gloves and sort of really sort of made a point. And actually she did such a bad job that actually when I got up out of the chair and walked out, the blood started running down my arm, because she'd been shaking and she wasn't comfortable with taking my blood. And that was only a couple of years ago. And so it still happens. It's still happening. This year I've had one person come to me who'd been kicked off a course when the course organisers found out that he was HIV positive. And he came to me, and we talked it through, and I was like, sue them. You know, this is absolutely, completely disgusting. It's completely... they're breaking the law. It's just there's no argument here. They're completely, your human rights are being crushed. And so he did. And after the talk, he was able to sort of go back and confront them a lot stronger. And actually, they backed down very quickly because they realised that actually they had broken the law, and he could have sued them. And actually, they put him back on the course. And he's actually now finished. But when I was working for NZAF as well, probably two or three times, I got a phone call from someone saying, oh, I've got a positive person who wants to work in my kitchen. I'm going, you better give them the job. But it was just like, it's basic, simple stuff, but the stigma around it, it's like, you should be, if you're working in a kitchen, it doesn't matter if you're HIV or Hep C, you should be aware of all, there should be guidelines to follow around cuts and accidents and to discriminate on HIV. It just shocks me and makes me incredibly angry, actually. So you don't want to get me on the end of the phone if you're asking those questions, because you'll get a right earful. But, I mean, that's... So within the health service, we've talked about stigma and employment. I think there's probably... when I talk to people, I say that actually you shouldn't put it on your employment. If you're applying for a job, it actually has no relevance to you getting that job. And actually, I think it's something you shouldn't put on an application for a job interview. It's not important. I suppose my question now is to the panel is, do you think there's more discrimination around within smaller groups, so around immigrants, around Indigenous populations, or within the gay community? Do you think there's more stigma there than what there is from mainstream?
I've got the stick, so I'll talk. But I don't want to talk about Indigenous, I won't go there, but I guess just something that, you know, talking about stigma, I mean, personally, I've never really had any bad experience around stigma. Nobody's done anything discriminatory, and I've been, you know, not really had any bad experiences. But in saying that, I kept it a secret for 17 years. And I think that is really what happens around stigma, is that people hide behind some sort of mask. And a lot of people living with HIV will not be public about their status. They will keep it to themselves and they won't tell anybody. And the biggest tragedy around that is that they are very isolated and you know, can lead to depression and keeping to oneself. And that hasn't changed, I think, in the 30 years. That stigma hasn't changed. And one of the things I see in the work that I do is that we have a lot of African migrants and refugees that have come over, and you know, with the publicity around internationally, globally, you know, Africa's got the highest, you know, 76% of people living with HIV come from Africa. So when these people come to New Zealand, they feel like just because they're black, they walk around with HIV written on their head, and that people just assume that they're HIV positive because, and they don't, people, the general public don't really say HIV, they're still saying AIDS. They don't really understand the difference between HIV and AIDS. And so they sort of, a lot of the African members that we have been heavily discriminated against. They've been asked questions like, have you had an HIV test, which is totally unconnected to anything else, just because they're black, because they're from Africa. So the stigma is still very much there. And I don't think it's changed. And I'll pass it on to anyone else who would like to.
Yeah, like Jane, personally, I've never experienced stigma myself. But what I do, well, maybe I have. I guess within our own community, within the gay men who have sex with men community, there is still a lot of stigma attached with being HIV positive. We hear things like, "Are you clean?" And yes, I've had a shower. You know, and I think that's one of the challenges that we face, is that Jane referred to the isolation. There are so many people who are HIV positive that I know, who don't even know that their best friend is actually positive, because they don't have the ability to talk about it, because it is so stigmatising in their community. Not even at the sexual level, but at the social level. It is not okay to talk about having HIV amongst a large number of people, even within our community, where in some respects it's even been normalised. And I think part of the challenge for us as positive people is to try and be a little more open about it and try and encourage other positive people to talk to us about it, so we can start building these networks. And I think that's something that, as organisations, we all struggle with. We can offer support, we can offer counselling, we can offer, you know, someone to go along to WINS, or we can enter into a debate with a potential employer or a health service on their behalf. But what we don't do particularly well is facilitate a community around HIV-positive people. We, as organisations, are often seen as the place you go when you've got a problem with being HIV, but there are a significant number of people out there with HIV who feel isolated, who have depression, who their lives are okay, their health is all right, they're muddling along, but they're incredibly isolated. And they're isolated because we don't talk about it in positive terms. When we have our conversations with people, be it on Grindr, online, in a bar, whatever, it doesn't come up. It's part of something we don't want to talk about, you know, and I think that's, there's a real challenge there for us, and I think that's something that we, as positive people, but also we as a wider community, have to start embracing and talking about it more openly.
Sorry, can I just add something to, just something that adds on to stigma is something that's, I don't know if you've heard this terminology of internalised stigma or self-stigma. And often what happens then is that people living with HIV take on all of those external you know, attitudes and actually believe it about themselves. And I guess from my perspective, like my partner and I finished 20 years ago, and I have not been in another relationship since then. And that's purely because I don't have the confidence to get into a new relationship because I've got HIV. And even though I work in the field and I'm out about my status, and I just don't have the confidence to go into a relationship because I feel that I'll be coming into a relationship, if they're not positive, at a lower level. You know, I'm going to be the one that something's wrong with that person. So, and that happens. That's my experience of it, and it's an experience that I have heard from a lot of other people as well. It's this internalized stigma where they feel dirty, they feel bad about themselves, and it attacks their own self-esteem, and that's what we call an internalized stigma.
Thanks, Jane. I can talk from personal experience with when I was diagnosed. It was pretty public, and I found that my entire community, my marae, my whānau hapū iwi, all found out at the same time I did that I had HIV. And the instant sort of reaction was, I couldn't cook in the kitchen at the marae, I couldn't do the dishes, I couldn't touch anything, I was dangerous, there was something wrong with me, don't drink, wasn't allowed to, you know, share cups or bottles or drinks. And I think the internal stigma stuff for me was that I was so afraid of the judgment that I would get from my own people that I withdrew completely. And I actually, the funny thing was, the people that actually held me up when I did withdraw were the gay community, were men from the gay community, and the Māori Takatāpui community were there for me. There was my uncle, Rex Perenaro, who was around way back, and he'd started a Māori organisation. It was all those guys that helped me with my diagnosis, even though I wasn't gay. And in a way, I was a minority as a woman, Māori and HIV positive. I had all these sort of marginalised things put on me, and that was, you know, 1993. But since then, you know, I've really made it my sort of life course to keep educating and talking, and I do a lot of sort of talks with my community or around Māori communities around Aotearoa, and one of the things that I found kind of crosses over is the takatāpui and the HIV thing crossing over into what I'm doing, in the sense of that there's still a lot of denial around it, and there's still a lot of stigma associated just with being takatāpui. Yet, it's actually part of the whānau. Like, everyone has takatāpui in their whānau. Everyone has a cousin or a whawhawhini or, you know, a whakawahini, transgender member in our family. And I thought about it going back for years in history. I had uncles, lots of uncles, that we didn't even think about twice. And I think it's for me, and I've said it, and you can quote me, I've said it in other articles as well, is that there is a form of sort of a thought process, introduced stigma that I call it, where our people have gone through these stages of colonisation over years and religion, and I'm not just talking about Māori, I'm talking about Pacific Island migrants, all sorts of things, where religion has really changed the way that people think, and it has sort of distanced themselves from through who their people are, from dangers of things like HIV, because it's sort of like, oh, that'll never happen to me, it's those people over there's problem. And so what I'm talking about is that when I go into the communities, it's actually peeling back all those layers of stigma and discrimination, getting to, you know, who we were as a people at the core, and then coming back to, you know, well, this is what can happen to your bokopuna or your grandchild. They're most definitely takatāpui, and they're going to go out in the world. If they don't know anything about looking after themselves, this is a real risk to them. And that's the conversations I end up having, and it's really funny because there's some hugely homophobic sort of attitudes, and right in front of you, I had this story. I was at this kaumātua's house, and he sitting up, you know, always have a kai when you're at someone's house, and this beautiful whakawahini came in, just awesomely gorgeous, and her grandfather was just downing everything to do with MSM, all of that. It was so anti it. And then an obvious transgender walked in the room and served us this beautiful meal. And I was looking at him, and I went, and he went, oh, he's all right. And I just realised that's the kind of difference. it's like, yes, for the talking sort of, they'll say what they think they're supposed to say, but on a real level, if it is in their whānau, they're completely loving and accepting, and it's just part of the process. But I will say, within Indigenous culture, sometimes we're harder on ourselves. So we do stigmatise ourselves harder. And I've got to acknowledge that my husband is here from Papua New Guinea. And it's another culture that is very much doesn't talk about this stuff. Because, it, first of all, it's illegal. It's very dangerous. There's religion involved. There's a lot of those sorts of stigmas and discrimination. So they come to New Zealand and we're so open talking about these things. But I suppose I'm rambling now. But the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, it does happen within our own Indigenous populations. And it's really up to us to shine a light on it and talk about it. Kia ora.
Thanks. So I think stigma has been associated with infectious disease problems for boys, and so it is, well, you know, as well as HIV, you know, it's certainly associated with other things like, you know, TB, hepatitis B, C, leprosy, you know, meningococcal disease, and it probably doesn't go away altogether. The things have improved in some respects. Certainly it was a bit unsettling to see a journalist from Wellington Hospital. I wasn't quite sure why he would be in respiratory isolation. I wondered whether, because of being so... I don't know anything about his circumstances, but I wondered whether they might have been worried about TB or something else like that at the same time, so far as the masks went, but it's hard to know. It was kind of reassuring to see that they had the old Wellington Hospital building that had been knocked down, so hopefully things have moved on. We have some things. I think we don't... the way that people's notes are kept and things are really mainstreamed much more than they were, so we don't really have separate charts or anything like that anymore. People are looked after... We are in a general clinic. They were talking about the needle stick accidents, and we have there are setups for blood and body fluid exposures, which really help to protect people where there is a real problem, but defuse the whole thing where it could get out of proportion. So those types of things are... arrangements help to deal with some of the things around the story around the policemen and the people who, where there was concern around but around possible exposure. And I think there is probably a lot more knowledge that you know, that there needs to be the exposure risk, for example, with cutaneous exposure and intact skin, you know, is really less than, you know, 0.3 in 1,000, and so that people, I think there's increased knowledge just how low the risk is, even with actual blood exposures. And yeah, I think one of the things that may be a factor as well is in some respects, as HIV's kind of become a chronic condition and less in the public eye, you know, then a lot of clinicians or public don't really see much about it. So it may be some of the things which we have changed and improved treatments really aren't known about. That's one thing. I think that the comments about employment, moving away from the health sector, I think the employment area, I think we've certainly seen people who have disclosed about their HIV applying for a number of jobs and, you know, been told that they'll be called back and never have. I suspect that employers may ask people specific health diagnoses too often, really, when I think that they probably really only need to know whether a health condition affects the person's ability to do a job. And so it's a functional thing rather than a diagnosis, I think. that's been easier to manage in the health sector, where we have occupational health physicians who can see people, and if they've got HIV or hepatitis B, and there are certainly nurses and doctors who have got all those at Wellington Hospital, and so they, you know, would have arrangements around whether they, there were particular things that they couldn't do, which for the large part is really in the hospital setting, would be involvement in major surgery as a doctor. So for nurses, that probably wouldn't occur much. But out in the community, really, there isn't a lot of reason, as you say, to. It would only really be if somebody is going to be away from work because of illness. And a lot of the time now, people are just attending clinic the odd time a year, so you're really talking about a fairly low impact. And I think I'm not quite sure how to get around that, that people are being asked what their actual health problem is rather than whether it impacts, you know, on their health.
You don't have to answer that job, that in a job interview anyway. It's no one's business. From the floor, is there any questions or comments or anything anyone wants to bring in on stigma before we move into media? Howie?
For me, stigma started before my diagnosis, so it just sort of carried on for me as far as I was concerned. But a lot of areas... In a lot of the areas of my life, it made it worse, especially in trying to find employment. Yeah. Up to even to this day, if the employer asks me my health status and I say, why is that important? And I says, I don't have to answer that. And they says, well, you're not getting the job. And that's been the response from an employer every time I've had a job interview.
They shouldn't even be asking the question. But yeah, I can believe it.
And as I said, I told them I don't have to tell you my status, my health status. And then they just turn around and say, well, we won't give you the job.
It's not a lot you can do with that.
No, exactly.
Thanks,
Howard. Yeah. Sometimes in that situation, we've tried to see where the GPs will sometimes do a note to say that somebody's got a chronic health problem, and that will mean that they might be, you get to get a rough idea of that they might be away from work, you know, whatever it might be, perhaps rather than. I think that's not an easy thing to do, but to be honest, but I think perhaps saying that somebody has a health problem, but without saying what it is, but perhaps then the GP might have some role in advising the extent that that might impact on a person's ability to do a job. But that's, I think that's a difficult one, but it's some sort of.
Thanks, Nigel.
I totally agree with what Jane and Will were saying about stigma, and I've got friends who are positive who won't go near a support organisation for fear of being exposed. I recently heard of someone in Auckland who Sarah converted, they became aware of their status that they were positive. And, you know, for no time at all, it was right around the community, and not in a particularly positive way. That's a bad... there's so many innuendos. But, you know, it went right around, and it's just... it's shit. Mm-hmm. And we don't talk about it in a... we don't talk about people seroconverting in a positive way. Anyway, it's really fucked up, that part. So I'm sitting here trying to think of what's a solution, and I don't have one. But one of the things which we did in the past, when I was at the Burnett Clinic years ago, was we did the education program. We would go around and talk to schools, and I remember going to Barbara Thornton, who was a terrifyingly large woman, and me being from abused like shit at school, it was kind of nice to go to a bar where I was still safe. But, you know, sending a gay man back to school to talk about AIDS was, you know, terrifying, but I did feel that worked. But the other part, the other component, which is really where you guys are heroes, is the Positive Speakers Bureau. And, you know, it's not really fashionable to get an HIV after dinner speaker, but it should be fashionable to have an after dinner speaker. You guys are heroes, and, you know, there's so many people who won't do what you're doing, so don't minimise, I mean, I'm not saying don't minimise, but, you know, celebrate what you're able to achieve. But in some way, the Positive Speakers Bureau, I don't know who used to run it, through the AIDS support network, was really, really good. So that might be one way, but I think it's really about education. When I look at all of the examples, and also gay men, and my experience, say, with gay men who are positive, who are HIV positive, and they can't get relationships because people won't have relationships with them and things because they're positive. It's horrible. Whereas really the reality is that if you treat everyone like they're positive, then chances are you might not see how it can be yourself. Education, I think.
Thanks, Hamish. Yeah, I've had that experience of not disclosing early in a relationship, and when I did disclose, they were gone. That's life. Right, we're going to move on to the next... up the back.
No, absolutely. This is a really good topic, and I just wanted to share my experience. So when I was diagnosed, I went to a couple of good friends of mine in the community and told them the diagnosis and the reason why my partner at the time and I hadn't been that well. And we were told, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone at all. Keep it to yourselves. And I was a little bit confused, probably for a couple of weeks, as to why that would be the case. And I understood, obviously, there would be some effects from people knowing and potentially treating me differently. But I sort of took it the other way, and I, within a couple of weeks, advised my employer of the diagnosis. And he was concerned. So I took it as an educational opportunity to tell him what the effects were going to be on his business. And in the end, ended up talking to the board of directors as to the effects on the business, which in essence was nil. But I guess the one thing that I did is sort of took it upon myself to educate people that didn't know. And I was lucky that I had people like Carl that helped me through that process so that I had the information that I could pass on to those that didn't have the information. And I guess that's just my sort of two cents and advice to other people is, you know, don't bottle it up. Actually, let's start educating the community about the effects that it has on the community, and that is nil.
Thanks, Dion. But it does take a strong character to be so upfront, and I would say you're in the minority, not in the majority. Most people actually see the idiots and actually give themselves a hard time and internalise stigma is very much something that we have to deal with, and I think it really, when you get a positive diagnosis, it can quite often really affect your self-esteem and your own sense of well-being.
Oh, but, Carl. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that from... I think a lot of people who have done that, I've talked to, have had a similar positive experience that most people... and family, you know, when they find out are supportive. One option is to leave that possibility open for a little while after you've got your head round it to start with, you know. But, not telling everybody right at the very beginning is one option. be more open and educating and finding that people, most people are decent, that it can be at the next step.
So I've actually worked as a patient advocate in the States at HIV clinic, and one of the things I'm curious about is, I think stigma usually is related to the way that we talk about HIV, and particularly to people who may not have somebody who's HIV positive in their immediate circle. So one of the things that I found is that, at least in the States, HIV is one of the few sexually transmitted diseases that's pathologized regularly in speech. And there's not really a good way, or at least widely known way, of talking about it positively or in a way that's accessible to people who don't really understand it. So I'm curious from the panel members whether you have any suggestions or ways that you can talk about HIV in a more accessible or positive manner.
I suppose coming from an employment point of view, I think we're starting to get into the last topic a little bit, actually. It's around the legalities of things. And at this current time in New Zealand, there's no legal requirement to disclose. When it comes to you offering to educate and disclose yourself, of course, you've got to weigh up the pros and cons of that. You've got to look at both sides of that. And most people, Jane can attest to this as well, that we've known through, say, organisations like Positive Women, is that it's actually been quite positive. There hasn't been any really bad sort of thing. And I think we started tonight's session and we're sort of going back, it's about 30 years of HIV, I suppose. And I think when we're getting up to, where we are now, where it's actually becoming a lot easier to talk about, mainly because the descendants is off the plate. So it's not hanging over our heads as the possibility anymore. The other side, though, talking about pros and cons, is that it's still really hard for women to disclose because of the partner issue and because the men do run for the hills. And I think, that's where, if we got onto the criminalisation of HIV, which is on the agenda, that's what I mean, we're swapping over a bit, we start looking at those sorts of issues. For women, it's a huge thing because there are a lot of women that don't disclose and with their sexual partners because they don't feel they need to at this stage. Where was I going with that? To expect everybody to come out and speak openly about their status is really asking a lot because there still was a lot of negative flatback of that. And I'm still getting it after having no time private, I've been open 21 years and I'm still getting it. I still get the parents of other people's children sort of not wanting their kids to play with my kids, I still get very subtle things. And I suppose what it's taught me is that I can't control how everybody thinks. I can't change the world all by myself, even though I try. And I think for me, I can only change my way of dealing with it. And if I see it and I go, oh, yeah, it's one of them. They're one of them. I put them in that category. Oh, they're one of those sorts of people. And then I move on with life and I get on with it. And I think the thing that I want to teach my children is to be the same way. It's none of my business what anyone else thinks of me. It's also, though, I do say to people, you don't have to disclose when you're applying for a job. And so, there are times when you just got to use your noggin and think about when is it a good time to disclose and when is it not. And trust your instinct as well. So should we go to media?
just one thing I wanted to say about that was I think one of the challenges that we have, particularly as a gay community, is that it wasn't so long ago that gay equaled AIDS in the Western world. Mm. So we have got the stigma. There's a lot of denial about HIV and conversations about HIV because to acknowledge HIV means, I can be gay without HIV and so I'm different, I'm somehow better, I am not AIDS. And I think there's a real big fundamental difference, particularly in the gay community, and why there's a lot of denial and why there's a lot of people not want to talk about it openly, because to actually openly acknowledge that actually it is a really big deal for us at the moment. You know, in New Zealand, we're about 1 in 20. In Australia, outgay men, it's about, you know, it's about 28%, I think, in some cities. You know, I think part of the challenge, I mean, it's not that much better in some parts of the states. I don't think it's about 32 up in San Francisco. So when you want to define and build a community and build your strength around it and have equality and have equal rights and be seen as human, sometimes in the community we want to be seen as not being AIDS. We want to be seen as being equal. And somehow part of the challenge with us as HIV positive people is to be seen as not less equal. You know. And so I think, you know, that is you ask a perfectly pertinent question. I think that is our challenge. It is our challenge to try and have these discussions so that we can engage positive people within our own community positively, but we just don't.
Thanks, Paul.
It just suddenly remembered. I was saying that I'm a member of Out at Work, which is a trade union based group, CTU, Centre for Trade Unions. And immediately I thought, well, it's like, well, I'm gay, I'm not only that, I'm a member of a trade union, which isn't the most fashionable thing amongst people. And also, being gay in the trade union movement isn't the most fashionable thing either. But there is a group you can go to try and work through the trade union movement. It's solidarity based and sympathetic. And I think recently we've been very concerned with matters of gender and move to try and get people who aren't straightforwardly male or female to get rights for people in that situation. And I felt over the, compared to tackling things 30 years ago, then I think in the trade union movement it's probably gone up the boil. It shouldn't have, but for various reasons, and it's been displaced, plus the fact that people are leaving unions rather than joining at times as well. So I've rambled on a bit, I think, about that, but there is a sort of niche, there is a place to go, but it is something to think about.
Yeah.
Definitely for me.
Yep, and you're right, it has gone off the boil. It's not discussed much anywhere these days. Do you want to move on to the next clip? We're going to play another clip, but we've already sort of started talking about some of this stuff anyway, so we'll play a clip and then we'll just carry on with talking about media and the media's sort of portrayal of HIV, which could be quite interesting, especially with some of the language that's been used recently around HIV in the media. I think one of the things that shocked me was when we heard about a child in Whangarei being asked to leave school, and I just was absolutely gobsmacked that here we were sort of 25 years on from Eva Van Graaff, and we were having a very similar story happening all over again, and I sort of wondered how far we'd actually moved in 20, 25 years. I thought it was quite horrific. And I think there was, for a lot of positive people, the language that was used around the Glenn Mills case was really disturbing. And quite negative towards for the positive people. I think I had a lot of people coming in and seeing me at work and being quite sort of disturbed by the whole media coverage of the Glenn Mills case. The floor, any questions, thoughts, ideas, questions for the panel? Or do I just go straight into the panel? Right, straight over to the panel. Thoughts around media?
I think just, yeah, we've got a couple of recent cases, but I think media played a huge part in sensationalising HIV for the last 30 years. And not only in our country, but all around the world. And it has attributed to the stigma and discrimination, to the fear, the panicking, the fear of getting tested in case that you've got that, what they're talking about on TV. Even in the early days, you know, there was Philadelphia recently. We've just had the Dallas Buyers Club. It's kind of brought it back up in people's sort of radar again. And then there was the Peter Mawai case in 93, which I was involved with. And I think, for me, I can say that if it wasn't for the media, I wouldn't have found out that I was HIV positive. So I kind of, in a way, thankful that the media were there. But on the other hand, it wasn't nice afterwards, and it continued to be quite awful. So there is a double-edged sword, and it took me at least 12 years to get a handle on how to deal with media. And I think it's now it's about us as positive people actually taking control of it and making sure that whatever's printed about us is with us first, and we approve of it. The sensationalism, those stories that came out about Glenn Mills and young boy up in Whangarei, I mean, it brings it to the people's attention again. Because, of course, you know, it's sensationalism. It's the media wanting to sell papers. It's people wanting to switch over and watch that TV program because this is happening. It doesn't do us any favours because it still makes us look dirty, makes us look like we've got something that, you know, we should be splattered all over the news about. I find that it's how you deal with the media while you're doing it. It's really learning. And Public Speakers Bureau training is very good in that sense, is that it has a component of media in there and how to work with media. Because media will twist your words. I've had them do it to me. I've had whole articles written about me that was completely untrue. And I've had Paul Holmes rubbishing me on when he was alive years ago on the radio. So kind of, you know, I've seen two sides of it. I think we need to also put, again, use our brains and realise that not everything we read is, again, there was media today, you know, that was a bit sensationalist for a lot of people in the HIV sector over the years. And I thought, well, here they go again. You know, they put AIDS in the same sentence as some other kind of abusive situation, which again makes us all look bad again, even though it's got nothing to do with HIV. It's filtering what's real and what isn't, and that's the hard challenge. And again, it takes more people that are living with HIV to speak up about it for that to happen.
I think it's really interesting when we refer to people like Eve von Grafthorst, who people may remember was a toddler who was thrown out of a kindy in Australia and was sort of sent back to New Zealand with her New Zealand mum and stuff like that. New Zealand embraced her in a way that we'd never seen anyone with HIV embraced with in New Zealand. And I think it's actually really impossible for us to understate or sort of to overstate the actual effect that having someone like Eve, really highly profile in the New Zealand media back in the late 80s and early 90s, was to New Zealand in terms of us actually being able to achieve some of the things that we did. I don't think that Catherine O'Regan would have been able to get through the anti-discrimination laws in 1993 if it wasn't for the profile that we managed to achieve, because one little girl who was HIV positive, who was thrown out of Australia, which actually helped New Zealand psyche, you know, educate us a bit. I think the saddest part of all that was that it didn't really matter how many gay men had died of HIV before then, it didn't matter in New Zealand until a 3-year-old girl had HIV. And I think that's part of the stigma and part of the challenge with media that we've got at the moment. You know, again, as Marama just referred to, you know, there was the case of a person entrusted to the New Zealand AIDS Foundation who has been convicted to, found, you know, punished today for sexually abusing some inappropriate people, well, people weren't inappropriate, he was inappropriate. But, you know, again, as Marama said, it was HIV, and again, another negative connotation. It continues that stigma, it continues that stuff, which is wider than HIV. It gets against our community. And so there is a role to play in me. And I think, you know, it's good that Jay's here to report on the proceedings tonight and take part in the discussion. But I don't think we can still put our hands on our hearts and trust the media. And I work for the media, okay, I work for the radio network, so I'm out there with that. I think we've got to be really careful with media. We still feel that we need to manage media. We still feel whenever the media wants to interview anybody or talk to anyone about HIV, we all take the sharp and take a breath and go, oh, fuck, now what? You know, we actually don't have that confidence in media, and I think we've got to get better at it. And we've got to educate media better about HIV and normalise it a lot more, because all those, every little chip that the media makes against us or against our community because of the perceptions of HIV is another little stigmatising thing that forces that person who's just been diagnosed not to confide in anybody, even their best friend who may also happen to be HIV positive. So,
I was going to throw a curveball in, but I think we'll just move on and I'll leave that for a bit later on if we've got time.
Sorry, Carl, can
yep.
I have a question?
Yeah, absolutely you can.
Media is it's a very broad term.
Yeah.
Who are we talking about in media? Who are we talking about in media to change this approach that we're referring to in the way in which we're reported? You know, is it the journalists specifically, or is it the entire industry?
It's probably the entire industry. It's wanting to. It's they sensationalise is a really good word, I think. But maybe Jay should answer this one. but I think it's a big picture. It's all about selling papers, isn't it? But Jay,
I'm going to come to the defence of some of our media. I think talking about the media is wrong. Talking about an interview on Morning Report or on 9 to Noon is different to talking about a bit of talkback on Radio Live. A beat up of the Sunday News is very different to a piece of the list. The two pieces that we've seen tonight that have struck me on the screen, the first one was the piece on the guys who came to the assistance of the road accident victim and got covered in his blood. I covered that from a gay angle. Some may know here, some may not. Most of New Zealand doesn't know, but the two guys who got covered in blood were gay. And the media knew that, in this case, Television New Zealand. And they quietly airbrushed that out of the picture in order to be able to clearly present outraged of whom they, Michael Westwood and his friend, concerned that the Ministry of Transport had not followed through and made everybody aware of what they needed to know. Those guys knew a lot more than we get from that picture about how exposed or not they may have been. But the media made it look like a bit of a, oh my God, it's HIV, oh my God, there could have been blood, oh my God, people could have got this virus, they could be dead by now story. It wasn't. It could have been played out like that, but that media played it the way we would want, whether you realise it or not there. What was the other piece? Oh, the piece with the young boy. And what they wanted to do there was another Ivan Van Bronckhorst. Didn't quite work out that way, but that's what they were trying to do. Ivan Bronckhorst was the only way of getting through to middle New Zealand the reality of HIV. Now, if we look at our media in New Zealand and overseas media, there's another split that we must make when we go, the media. The first representations of HIV that we got in New Zealand were from overseas media, from CBS News and things like that, filtered through our networks, but it was all that was available. And what did we see? We saw poor little children with AIDS, due to the wording of the time, surrounded by cuddly toys and bunnies and hospital-looking powder wine, concerned parents around them and all the rest of it, you know, in some cases nuns and God knows what else. And when we saw men with HIV, gay men, we saw gaunt, cadaverous figures lying alone, drooling in a bed, and referred to as AIDS. And we had this AIDS victim thing and all that crept in. So the media is not a megalith. It's not homogenous. And we have to be careful that we don't tar New Zealand media with the overseas brush, because in fact, the New Zealand media has been a shining example to the media overseas on how not to attack gay men. We think of the days of Anita McNaught. We wouldn't have heard much of Eve Van Graaffelt if it hadn't been for Paul Holmes. Paul Holmes championed her. He knew what he was doing, not shooting. And he was pushing Eve Van Graaffelt right into the middle of every living room in New Zealand. And he was making every living room in New Zealand, the subject was HIV. She was the only example that would work to get our agenda as gay men who were those who were predominantly being affected into those living rooms. Because as soon as he had mentioned gay men with HIV, half New Zealand would have turned out. Not intentionally. Just little girls, yeah, tugs at the heartstrings. So I think we have to be careful before we ascribe very black and white and self-serving attitudes in the media, because often there's a backstory that you do not see, because if you saw the backstory, the story would be different and it wouldn't serve our purposes so well.
Thanks, Dan. Did that help answer your question?
Which was exactly what John Campbell did with the Whangarei Boy thing. He actually knew there was a lot more to the story behind it all, but he did the story one night, and then I was interviewed the night after, and there was a lot more to that story. But his motivation that he told me was he thinks that HIV needs to be in the media more.
Yes.
And,
it's not in the media, it's not relevant, it doesn't exist, it doesn't get funding, it doesn't get column inches, it doesn't get support, it gets airbrushed out, and we all suffer.
So, so there's positives to that as well. Where's our guy
from? Mike Boy. Hi, I'm Phil Rogers. Now, I've worked through this era right from the days of AIDS as a producer of Greek television in New Zealand and an archivist. I just wanted to say this. I managed to direct that program we saw Bill Southwood in was one of the first we did that actually touched the subject. It was taboo. We had a producer in television New Zealand at the time, I should mention his name, dear old Mark Westmoreland, who suffered one of the first AIDS sufferers in New Zealand. He continued working. It was tragic to see at the time because no one understood. He walked around like a zombie, but he could walk into the television studio and still direct the program. It took a lot of understanding from a lot of people. I did the first program on suicide in New Zealand. It was tragic, it was hard to get on, but the point of the program was not about suicide, about teen suicide, was about how to support it, how to get the information out there and make people aware. Now, I think you're now living in an era where mass media television has now been completely diluted. When we put a program on, it went to the whole of New Zealand. The television audiences are dropping. So whatever message you give is not getting across the great mass. The biggest danger we have at the moment is the social media, like Facebook and other medias, starting off on a tangent, and I've seen it on a Facebook post I've done, where someone's made a cynical comment and the whole thing has gone off in a totally different direction. Now, the thing you have to do with that, I think, is it is a media. It's self-reporting. It's the me, and all that sort of thing, selfies. And you're going to get more and more of that. And I hope it's not at the tragic consequence of some people around who are getting misguided or whatever, and labelling people wrongly, because I think there's been a lot of positive things with AIDS now, with HIV and all that. I think there's getting quite positive messages out there because there's a lot of support around and people talking about it. The key thing I would say to anybody in the media now is make up your mind whether you want to tell the whole world about your problem or whether you want to tell people how to move forward. In other words, you've learned from this and what about it. Sometimes you can say no, I don't want to be on. It's hard to do sometimes, but you're also very difficult when you get a microphone placed in your face these days that you're not making a comment, because the media has turned into that sort of thing. And before we have, we speak, we ask, we telephone, we make people sure. These days, all that's gone, the standards, in my view, have dropped, and it does put a consequence on people trying to explain the situation. They can be made to look a fool. So my advice to anybody these days is think very carefully and don't comment until you're sure you know what the hell's going to happen, because you've got to live with it. I used to be an archivist. It goes in the archive, it sits there forever. And Peter Dunn is the latest thing on one of the media things. As I remember hearing things coming out of him at the moment, which he gets his secret, not about this topic. So all I'm saying is the media, the biggest danger for us these days is not the television media, not the radio, not the newspaper, because they generally have professional standards. It's the social media getting out of hand. And somehow out of the best you can do is what you've got now. You've got websites around. Hopefully someone is monitoring what's going on and can feed some of the correct information out.
Thanks, Phil.
Just want to say, I think, you know, you're both right in terms of, like, the, you know, saying the media is all one. However, it's still, here we are in, you know, 2014. The time that we get to mainstream media as a community generally is either when something goes horribly wrong or there's a child involved. Now, that we get shaped by media. We don't shape the media. The media shapes us. And I think, you know, if we look at Ebron Graft, also we look at the boy in Whangarei last year, how many other positive stories are there in the general media about HIV positive people where there's no story, where there's no outrage, where there's just actually a role modelling of good behaviour or just a good life? We don't get represented. You know, and I think we've had that argument, you know, as a gay community going back for many, many, many years, and we still get outraged, or we get outraged when someone gets outraged that there's a lesbian kiss on Shortland Street. You know, we don't actually get the normalisation of HIV in the community. Without that normalisation, it's very, very difficult to talk about. It contributes to the isolation, it contributes to the stigma. And so I can take your points that, yes, the media were very manipulative at the times when they were choosing these children to use as our heroes. And, you know, I don't want to take anything away from that, but it can be an and. It doesn't have to be an either-or. And I think that is our challenge, is to actually work out how do we get our lives, our stories, our voices normalised in New Zealand so that the stigma disappears and the challenges with that disappear.
I think this is one point I'd make to that, is that normal is not news. That if you put a picture on the front cover of Woman Today magazine, Rachel buys milk at dairy, you've got to sell a certain number of copies. Rachel has breast cancer. Will go off the scale.
Yeah.
Normal is the news. Mm. And that's a human nature, not the nature of the media, it's based on human nature.
Yeah. Thanks, Jay. And I mean, I could say that I'm guilty of that. I've done a lot of Women's Day magazines and other women's magazines, and most of it, the headline will be AIDS victim or Peter Mawai victim, or, you know, but then it would get into a story about how I've moved on with my life, I've had children, they've got HIV negative, you know, all the positive things that have happened. But you still got to, the only way you get their attention is if you go straight to that what I call, it's like having a...
pinpoint.
Yeah, something that will grab attention. And a lot of, I mean, sadly, and I've seen it so many times, not just in this country, but around the world, people get HIV, and they think, well, I'm going to get famous now, I'm going to start doing, you know, documentaries and TV shows and all this stuff, but they haven't got that catch, they haven't got that thing that, if they've got just a normal old story, they got HIV because they had a good night.
Nobody wants to know.
Exactly, and it's almost, and I hear it all the time, and it's how do you say to someone that you're not extraordinary, when to us you are, but it's in that sense, in media, it's not extraordinary. And we've seen that so many times with women.
Unless you're a celebrity.
Yeah,
but I do think we need media. And we, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say up there that, you know, you can say no. I have to admit, we very rarely say no. Because any opportunity is... I don't actually say any opportunity is better than none, because sometimes I wish I had said no. But, you know, we get calls like, come up to World AIDS Day, can you provide us with this, you know, 16-year-old beautiful woman who's just been diagnosed, as if to order we can just put somebody on the front page of the newspaper with their story. So it's a kind of a love-hate relationship. I mean, I wouldn't even say hate. It's a very nervous relationship with the media, because you... I really understand now when you hear famous people or people on the news saying it was taken out of context, you really begin to understand that saying. But we need media, and it's important for us to learn how to use them to our advantage, which is not an easy task.
I'm going to pass on to Ron to talk a bit about nowadays what happens with testing and the support. But I will just, it does make me laugh now, but I was diagnosed in 1988 and I had to go and have blood taken. And I had to go back and get my results, and the doctor walked into the waiting area and looked at me and said, I'm sure you're not surprised, but you are positive. And that was it. And he went back to his office and I walked out. Thank goodness it isn't still like that.
Yes, I've heard of, actually one of my good friends, a lot of you will know, who died several years ago, was Michael Hay, and he was in Rotorua when he got told over the phone from his GP that he had AIDS. And as a consequence of that, he started BAS, Bay Area AIDS Support Service, and I was working for Lifelink Youthline as a phone counsellor, and so together and with other volunteers we fielded a few calls and that which was, you know, really, really good. But yeah, getting as far as testing goes nowadays, both New Zealand AIDS Foundation and us, and we do rapid testing. We actually do it from our centres and also out in the community as well. We still do pre and post-test counselling. We feel that that is very important. We get them to fill in a risk assessment form, and that gives the person taking the test a level of risk to that particular person. And through the process of the testing, we'll talk to them about their risk and about their sexual practices, and use it as an opportunity also to educate, because there's a lot of people out there that don't know the risks, so we use that as a time to educate. And as far as going through the testing, it's a pretty simple way of doing testing now. It's a screening test. It's a finger prick that we use. And if we do get a positive, then the biggest thing, as positive people, we can, talk to them and support them. And certainly from our organisation and New Zealand AIDS Foundation, that's the primary care is to that person, and to make sure they're safe and kept safe, and to get the support that they need, and to offer the support that they need, whether it be through our own organisations or seeking external organisations to help. And so once we do get a positive result, we will then, certainly in Wellington, I'll ring James Rice at the back there, and we'll facilitate a what we call a Western blot test, which is a confirmatory test. But the main thing is to make sure that they are safe and that they are kept well informed. And the biggest thing, I think, from a newly diagnosed newly diagnosed person is that generally what happens is they shut down, and they everything that you're saying to them, they're just thinking about other things. So they're not thinking about what you're telling them. So I guess the main thing is to sort of just make sure they're safe, and you know, eventually sort of keep talking to them about when it's appropriate to support them in whatever they need, and of course talking to another positive person is a big plus. We've had several people that we have engaged with, and we offer other services, so one-on-one counselling or group counselling sessions with other positive people. And of course the journey that a positive person has gone through is very powerful to a newly diagnosed person, because you can tell them your story and you can show them that, hey, you know, you're no longer going to die of this virus. In fact, I think you'll back me up, Nigel, that we had a specialist come out from Australia and said a positive person's life expectancy against a negative person is actually, as far as men go, is greater, because we get to go to the doctor once every 6 months or once a year, and we get our blood pressure taken, and we get our doctor touch us and, you know, check us all over and do all the normal stuff. Whereas men generally don't go to the doctors unless they're absolutely sick and something's absolutely wrong with them. So, yeah, that's our way of doing testing. Mm.
Yeah, just in terms of your question there, I think, you know, it's hard to crystal ball gaze exactly, but I do think that I hope you don't mind when we hassle about people stopping smoking incessantly and things like that, because those things do make a big difference, and I think some of the day-to-day things like that, simple things like blood pressure control, will make a big difference for people with HIV, and sometimes if they've been attended to rather than neglected, that will make a positive difference. I think, yeah, so the counselling is obviously in the 80s, when there was no effective treatment, you know, there was quite a lot of consideration about, you know, whether to get tested at all, because it came with so much abuse. But now that treatment is, you know, not perfect, but you know, very effective, then it really is important that more people are diagnosed. And I think so the counselling shouldn't go the other way. You know, that Ron was describing where there's no counselling at all, but it needs to be somewhere balanced so that more testing is done, because at the moment, still, you know, half of people who are diagnosed roughly too late. And, you know, we want there to be earlier diagnosis and, you know, more extensive diagnosis of people who don't know that they're affected.
When I was diagnosed almost 10 years ago, my first port of call was the NZA, because that's the only place I knew of. And then I moved on to the body positive group, which has been, both have been very helpful to me to even get as far as I have today.
Thank you.
I think one of the challenges that we have here in New Zealand is that although we offer really good services within the organisations here, we're not universal, we're not everywhere. And so the majority of diagnoses that actually come from in New Zealand for people who are HIV positive do not come through any of the organisations represented here. Most of them come through sexual health clinics or GPs. And it really relies on those people and that primary interface to actually try and engage these people with positive services. Now, we are limited by capacity. I mean, New Zealand AIDS Foundation has really only got offices in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch. We've got contract councillors all over the country. Body positive, similar, you know, with only Auckland and Wellington. But a lot of people are not actually necessarily seeing service in the areas or recognising service in the areas. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have to face up to. So when people are getting diagnosed, even though they might want to talk to somebody, they don't necessarily get put in that right place. And I think there's a job for all of us to do to make sure that with primary health and with the GPs and also with the sexual health clinics around the country, that we actually get better at being able to connect with those people who are newly diagnosed to offer them support and some form of contact at that time.
Yeah, I'd really like to endorse that as well. I mean, for me personally, I think it was that belonging to a support network and going to counselling was something that really helped me through those early years. And subsequently, I've ended up working in an organisation that offers that support. And what I do find nowadays in particular is because we're only one small organisation, our focus is on women and families. And we're based in Auckland, and there's roughly 500 women in New Zealand living with HIV, and they're scattered all over the country. And so it's really hard to have access or to get those women to have access. You know, if you're living in I don't know, Gore, it's not a good example because we have one of our board members lives in Gore, and she's very active. She's very active down there. But, you know, some small little rural community, even though we have an 0800 phone number so that people can call us at any time, it still feels very distant for that person. You know, it's a phone call, it's somebody at the end of the phone. For some people it's something, but for a lot of people it's like, oh, well, no, just get on with it. And I think in this day and age things have changed because of the medications. And even though we provide a lot of services in Auckland, we find that a lot of our members don't actually take them up because they're out working now and they're out living their lives. And really what we're seeing is that people want to be part of an organisation, but only when they need it. So, you know, it's quite interesting. So to be able to sustain, like, there's no way that we could even afford to have an office in Wellington or in Christchurch or anywhere else. There isn't the need for it. We couldn't afford it. So it's quite difficult to reach everyone, and it's difficult.
And I suppose for our organisation, we're sort of based semi-rural, and I do a lot of travelling. I do a lot of driving around the country, and the people that we're supporting are living in very, very isolated rural areas. Most of them, hardly anyone knows their status. And what enables us to actually do this is whānau ora. If you've heard it in the press and all through media, it is because of whānau ora that we're able to actually go and meet with these people. Sometimes we get to meet with their whānau, sometimes it's just them. We're always referring them to NZAF Body Positive and Positive Women, and you know, if they successfully do go through to those support services, it's a goal for us. But it doesn't happen all the time, and I'd like to say that, you know, those Māori living with HIV in isolation, they really take isolation to the extreme, where the fear of being associated with an organisation is huge, even to get near me. Half the time, I get to them through someone who knows someone, and it's a phone call or a text message, and I'll meet them at some bar or shady little town somewhere, and you know, they don't want me to go to their house yet, and I have to be aware of the environment that I'm going into and who I'm talking to, and speaking their language. You know, I can't go in there and start talking UN AIDS. you know, I've got to come right down to their ground level and talk and find out what's happening for them at that, what's the biggest need for them. And last year I was actually getting quite nervous because a lot of them were coming forward not wanting to have treatment, and was really, as part of their final order process, is actually, you know, looking after their well-being. Is that how do you get people onto treatment? And I'd like to say out of 21 final order that we've done in the last 18 months, all of them are on medication now. And I'd say easily 50% of them weren't before. Mm. And that to me is just one whānau at a time is the only way that we can do it. And it's really hard because you have all the psychological, psychosocial issues, all the situations like one particular whānau. She lived with 8 family members. Taking a handful of pills once a day wasn't just an easy thing to do because everyone would see her doing it.
Any questions from the floor, Jim?
Just simply the question of isolation, is it another way of saying people are poor as well? I find it, the median income in New Zealand is 24,000, I think it was, inequality level, inequality a New Zealand issue, question. It seems, I spent a lot of my time looking or thinking about that, some of the basic economic questions. It doesn't seem to be very happy in those terms, and when people have money in their pockets and they have work and being sacked is less at risk or they're not working part-time, the whole sort of economic tone of the country, is that impacting on, is that affecting?
A lot of the times it impacts on travel, getting to their specialist. Like they don't want to go to a specialist if it's 2, 3, 4 hours away. Even though some of the DHBs do reimburse travel, it's after the fact. So then a lot of times we've actually given out money to in the front so that they could actually get to the appointments. So yes, the economics is a huge thing. I don't quote me on exact, I haven't seen the latest census data, but for a Māori, a median average income for a Māori whānau is around 15,000 a year. So then it's a whole different level again. And a lot of our whānau are living in communal situations where there's mum, dad, brother, sister, all sharing a very small space, and that brings up other issues around their safety. What else can I talk about there? Jobs and things like sickness benefits. They've gone and applied for sickness benefits from WINS, and they've had stigma discrimination in WINS offices because instantly, if you disclose your status, you must be gay, a drug user, or a prostitute. And you might not be any of those things, but that's the judgment that's put on you, or a slut.
Imagine if you are all of those things.
Yes, exactly. Good on you. But again, it impacts even on them wanting to disclose at a WINS office.
Isolation definitely, you're talking about, definitely is an issue for some people, particularly some of the immigrants, you know, who are tested through immigration testing. I think the income, you know, is definitely a factor. There was the Futures study a few years ago. It hasn't been repeated for quite a while, but I think the people's income is often a factor in access to primary care. You know, Body Positive's been doing a lot of work around that. We have a social worker part-time who helps with things like housing and social work issues, but those are definitely practical issues. There are some immigrant people who are very isolated, really, just come to see the doctor, and it would be quite nice to connect them with support organisations more, actually, but getting them over that hurdle is sometimes a challenge. Yeah. And so, you know, we'd be pleased for any clues about how to do that better. Obviously, people like James there have a great deal of experience and care and support issues too.
Yeah. Got 10 minutes left to go. And I think we might sort of think about the future. One of the things that I've been I'm aware of is that we talk about stigma, and the word AIDS seems to be absolutely steeped with stigma. And one of the things I've probably had to deal with more when I've been out and about is actually explaining to people the difference between HIV and AIDS. Actually, people don't really know. It was really funny. I hope you don't mind, Gareth, but Gareth and I were talking last Thursday. And it's really simple, but actually surprised Gareth a little bit that actually I had an AIDS diagnosis back in 98, and then by 1999 I didn't have an AIDS diagnosis. And actually people still get very confused around HIV and AIDS. And actually, in the West, we're almost entering a post-AIDS era. Yes, we are getting people who are presenting with AIDS, but they shouldn't be. They should have been tested before, and they shouldn't be getting to that point. The Terence Higgins Trust have actually dropped the words AIDS. They don't use it anymore. They use the word, they have HIV and progressive HIV. So you're HIV positive, and if you do get really sick, then they'll use the term progressive HIV. Part of that was to deal with the stigma that AIDS, the word AIDS, it's dealing with that stigma, and so they don't use it anymore. And the argument is that really people in the West, I have to say, because it's not global, but really in the West, people actually really die of an AIDS-related illness. They might die of there might be a complication around HIV, but actually it's not often that you're going to get people dying of AIDS. So I think that's thoughts from the panel on terminology. Do you think we should be dropping AIDS? Do you think we should be more clear around what's the difference between HIV and AIDS? Do you also have that experience of people mixing the two up quite regularly? I mean, I could quite often get, you're an AIDS person, and it's like, actually, I'm not. I'm HIV positive. I don't have AIDS. So, yes, excellent. At the end, Nigel.
It certainly is that AIDS isn't the predominant issue anymore. It won't be gone, but it's really when it was the 80s and the early 90s when it was the predominant issue. You know, the issue is more about other healthcare support and some of the other issues that you've talked about. So, in that sense, it makes sense to not talk about AIDS as much, or to talk about us being in a different era where it's not the prime issue anymore.
I'm going to put on two hats. My first hat is from an Indigenous worldview. We are still rating quite highly in the AIDS, being diagnosed at AIDS stage. Māori, Pacific, and Indigenous, I'm talking about Western world. I think a lot of the times is, again, around health access to testing, health disparities, not really knowing what illnesses are and being in situations where there aren't doctors that can say, oh, that might be an AIDS-related illness or not. You know, those sorts of things can happen. That's one thing. Also, we're seeing a lot, not just in New Zealand, but in Australia and Canada, we're seeing a lot of Indigenous people just choosing to have AIDS, to actually not take medication, to actually, like I said before, let it go its gauntlet, I suppose. And some of them, I have a really good friend, an Aboriginal friend, who is quite proud to say that she's got AIDS and that she's never actually got a CD4 above the level that takes her out of an AIDS diagnosis. So there's a way of claiming it and making it a positive thing as well. I don't think we're ready to eliminate it yet. And I mean, it would be nice to think so in a New Zealand context, but we have an epidemic in the Pacific Islands. we have numbers going up in Australia. I don't think we're at that stage where we can say it's over yet. They haven't got the cure yet. So I'd like to be hopeful. However, on a personal level, I always say I'm HIV positive and educate on what AIDS is. I've never had an AIDS-related illness. I've never been anywhere near the AIDS numbers to have AIDS. But I do get a lot of how can two HIV positive people have HIV negative children? You know, that's the kind of questions I get. They people really can't understand how that medically, biologically happens. So, I mean, I use it as an example to explain it.
Yeah, I just think just because something doesn't sound nice, you shouldn't get rid of it. I mean, it doesn't make it go away. It's still there. And I think globally, AIDS is there. There's thousands, millions of people dying, every year with AIDS-related illness. It's still there. So I think it would be inappropriate to get rid of the word. I guess, you know, just because you don't like the connotations, I think it's better to educate, and I think we would be looking to do that. And I guess looking to the future, I mean, for the last 3 years, I've actually worked as the Asia-Pacific NGO representative on the UNAIDS board, and they're now doing their, you know, future plans and looking at 2020. I mean, they're looking at talking now that there won't be a UNAIDS because HIV will become another STI and will be incorporated into general health and general sexual health, and it won't be a standalone. So, you know, the fact that people are not dying, and, you know, in the future, the more people that get access to medications, people won't be dying and we won't be seeing so many people with AIDS. I think it will reduce, and I think we will see quite a different picture in the next 20 years. Some goods, you know, that's good to that, but I also personally, I guess, feel that HIV is quite different to a lot of the other STIs, and I do feel that it needs a little bit more attention and it needs to be a standalone. My opinion, which means nothing.
Yeah, personally, I am relatively ambivalent whether someone thinks they have AIDS or someone thinks they have HIV. I don't care. Mm. I don't want to be one of those people that says, I'm gay, yes, I have HIV, but I don't have AIDS. Mm. Somehow having HIV is better than not having AIDS. It's part of that stigma, it's part of that double labelling, and I would prefer that it's just one word, actually. You know, a funny story. I had a friend of mine I was meeting for lunch the other week, and she texted me to say, she's got cancer. She texted me to say, oh, I'm sorry I'm running late, I've got cancer. I said, well, I've got AIDS, I've still made it on time. You know, I think we've got to be a little bit not too precious about the language. Mm. I think the points are really well made that it doesn't really matter where you are on the continuum of this virus. We have this virus that is going to affect our lives one way or the other. I don't really care where it crosses one definition into another, and that will vary from country to country. I mean, we're already, you know, whether the CD4 count is 200, 100, 400, 500, it really doesn't matter. You know, in a westernised world, we're probably heading towards the point where, you know, within time, the treatment diagnosis will, in terms of access to treatment, will be decided between the clinician and the patient. It won't actually be decided by an arbitrary number that's picked out of the year that someone else decides. So I would rather there was just one word for it, because we are all in the same boat. And, yeah, so that's where I'd sit on it. So.
Sweet.
Robin. Yeah, I would just like to see HIV, to be honest. Just from the point of view that AIDS was an old term, well, it's, I mean, I hear what the panel is saying about overseas and in the Pacific and that. But in New Zealand, it's HIV that is happening predominantly, and AIDS to me is an old thing, and I just sort of feel that when people call me, oh, you've got AIDS or you've got HIV, I feel that HIV is a more nicer word, you know, because it's true. It's true. Whereas I don't have aches, and that's maybe just that's just my feeling anyway. That's what I sort of feel. I just aches to me is a long time ago. That's me.
Chad.
I have a tendency to agree with Jane. I've probably been writing about HIV longer than any journalist in New Zealand now, I think, and practically on a weekly basis. And in the last few years, I've had to struggle with how I write up HIV, because I had two or three different audiences. We had two different audiences here. We had people with HIV, and we had people without HIV. And the situation is different for both. I've been taken to task by people with HIV for making HIV out to be a bad thing. And it generally goes along the lines of, how dare you add a negative connotation to HIV when I'm trying to give myself positive feelings and reinforce my sense of self-worth and the fact that I've overcome the HIV and I'm living with HIV, that I'm a well-rounded person, blah, blah, blah. And my reaction is generally, it's a shame you've got HIV, but you do have resources to support you, mostly. We'll finesse the way out of isolation and scattered population, but in general, you have medics who are available to help you come to terms with the mechanics of what's happening with you. There is supportive information available. People without HIV are the ones in our gay community who are in danger of getting it. And so we have to make it relevant, and that underscores every story that I write. So then I have to say, how do I make this relevant? How do I make this story into a reminder to people who don't yet have HIV that it's not a good thing to get, mm-hmm. and you have to avoid this if you possibly can. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we minimise to take the emotion and take the difficulty out of HIV. If we start treating it as herpes, mm-hmm. which is also untreatable, but nobody seems to worry about herpes very much anymore, do they? Mm-hmm. You know, put cream on, carry on. If we minimise HIV just because it's because AIDS is old-fashioned, or because it's not quite technically correct anymore, or because it's not quite so relevant, we take away one of the most potent words we have on grabbing people by the balls and saying HIV could affect you really badly. And I know it's not quite true, but we haven't got many other things that are arsenal as writers to hit the button on this one. And if we just mellow everything out into HIV, we lose the message, and then we start losing the battle against it. We succumb to a thing that says, well, because it's not such a big problem, we just medicate it. Well, that's just life, and everybody ends up with HIV, and everybody ends up medicated, and governments will eventually be able to find all the money to do that, and we'll all get on with it. I think it's a very dangerous thing to do until we've got an alternative. I wish there was an alternative. I can't find one.
Thanks, Jack. Is there anyone else that wants to just have a quick word before we wrap up?
I'd like to see at some point HIV become more mainstream, and I like the idea of I love the term HIV positive. I'm a cancer survivor. I've been living with cancer for 11 years. Changing my terminology from patient or victim to cancer survivor has done a hell of a lot for me personally, emotionally, and with cancer, you suffer the same things. You get withdrawn, you don't talk about things, you hide from people. What I would hate to see in any near future is the attention that HIV and AIDS gets in the media. empowering writers to actually utilise it and to still have the attention grabber of those very small words. But it's still going to do a hell of a lot to pull someone into that article to read more. I've learned a hell of a lot in the last couple of years about HIV, AIDS, STIs, and everything else to do with sexual health, and I'm one of these people that thought HIV and AIDS were the same thing.
You're not alone.
I seem to have missed a whole portion of the media at some point in my life, quite possibly when I was withdrawn and not paying attention to the rest of the world. But I think if you and AIDS are looking at 2020 or in the future at some point of mainstreaming things, yeah, that would be good. That gives us a stake in the ground. But I think we'd better get it right before then, before we make it mainstream.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, I think it's gone 8:30. We'll just go back to the panel quickly then, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a sort of a balance between the positive view of things as you're describing, and also in but not minimising things either. I think as much as we do want to be optimistic, you know, there are health concerns around risks to do with heart disease and cancer and other health problems which appear to be, which have a greater increased risk. And even though people talk about it, you know, being a chronic manageable condition, which compared to other things like diabetes, you know, those are significant health problems as well. So, and plus having to come and see doctors all the time and have blood tests and the other aspects, the subtle, you know, psychological effects of being positive, that it's important not to minimise. And you know, I think the challenges around prevention and having to keep up the efforts there, you know, are going to clearly be important, you know, combining all the measures that are known to be helpful. So, I think it's important to not lose sight of the importance of prevention as well as trying to put a positive face on the care of people.
Just quickly, with what Jay was saying as well, I think I'm going to plug Public Speakers Bureau here. The Public Speakers Bureau for people living with HIV, within the training, there's a lot on how to actually navigate that by putting a positive swing on it, but also putting a reality swing on it. You know, the reality is we do have to take really strong medication every day. We miss that and we bugger it up, we've got to start another regime. You know, so there's those reality stories around the medication that we have. I have diabetes, high blood pressure, I've got all those other, you know, added stuff that Dr. Nigel's talking about. But also too, I'd like to say that on a global level, there's a real strong movement of people living with HIV. And I say I am a person living with HIV, and I know that there's 30 million of us. And quite across the world, as far as advocacy and activism, you know, there's some really strong gay men activists out there doing such amazing things, and things like the World AIDS Conference, which is in Melbourne this year in July, and we have our Indigenous Pre-Conference, which is in Sydney. And it's in those places. I've been on the last two International AIDS Conference organising committees. What I've seen there is the strength of the people living with HIV really calling the shots at that level, and the PCB that Jane has been on. You know, we should be proud to be people living with HIV. That's how I feel. In New Zealand, yes, you know, we're limited because we're so far away from the world, But the social media, the internet, all those things bring the world so much closer. I'm talking to international countries every single day on Skype, every day. And there's a chance there for all of us living with HIV to be part of a huge community of really strong, positive people living with HIV. So, kia ora.
Yeah, I don't really know how to finish it off. I don't think it can be finished. There's no end, really. No, I mean, there's still a lot of work to do. I mean, I do find in my role as a coordinator for Positive Women that I talk two different talks to whoever my audience is. So if, as a newly diagnosed positive woman comes in, you talk about all the positives to you know, make her feel better and to make her feel hopeful. And then when you're speaking to people on the prevention side, you bring up all the things that Mara was saying. And one of the things I often say, especially when talking to school children, is like, just imagine at 16 you were diagnosed with HIV. And then you have to tell your friends, and then later on when you meet your girlfriend or your boyfriend, you have to tell them, and you know, there might be rejection there, and you know, then you have to go on to having children, and that can't always be done naturally, and then you have children, and then you have to tell your children, and you have to go on to medications, and there's side effects from the medication, so it's, and there's stigma, right? And so it is quite different to other STIs, and it's still it's not a pleasant thing to live with, and you wouldn't want anyone to have it. So it's about balancing that. And I think, yeah, I think we just have to keep on keeping on, just keep on. And as far as the Positive Speakers Bureau, I just Positive Women manages it on behalf of all of the support networks. So it belongs to all of us. It's just that it's easier for one organisation to manage it, and so we run training groups every twice a year to train people who are living with HIV how to go about speaking publicly, and then we really push to try and get into schools and get into hospitals and get into conferences and get those people to go out and talk about being positive and what it's like and educating. So it's, and I think that's what we have to keep doing. We have to keep educating. Education is the biggest thing, and we have to keep pushing for that. And I'd like to see HIV tagged on to the STI, STIs and HIV. This is and HIV, just so that it can be in everybody's conscious a little bit more. That's me.
I think there'll always be a tension between me as an individual wanting to live a happy, positive, engaged, rewarding life, and me also not wanting anyone else to catch this virus. And if the price of me helping someone else not get that virus is that my life is a little less good or a little more awkward, then that's a price I'm prepared to pay. It's really easy to sit back and say, well, HIV isn't what it was, or AIDS isn't what it was, because it kind of isn't. That's a truism in this world anyway. But the reality is, we don't want it. We don't want diarrhea all the time. We don't want to be vomiting. We don't want to have the headaches. We don't want to have the fatigue. You know, with the best medication in the world, that is what we live with. And, you know, I will put myself out there and be a little uncomfortable to stop someone from feeling that living with HIV is a comfortable experience. It isn't. And I think we have to come back to that point. And there's always going to be that tension between making people with HIV feel valued and part of the community and alive and helpful and resourceful and all this stuff. But we've got to stop people getting this virus. That's it.
I think everyone has said what I want to say. So I'm going to use this as a bit of a plug for our Candlelight Memorial Service. On Sunday the 18th at Te Papa Museum, we've got a number of guest speakers, politicians, two choirs, performers at 2:30 on Sunday the 18th. So do come along if you can. It'll be a wonderful, wonderful night. And then afterwards at Rush Bar, they're putting on a tribute, candlelight tribute, straight after at about 5 p.m. With a charity auction and nibbles and drinks and party time to celebrate those that have gone. Cheers.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming along. Thank you, and thanks to the panel. It's been really good, and it's great that we're having discussions like this. And let's hope they carry on, and they don't have to be in this format. Have them at your dinner parties and have these discussions around the table and over coffee, and it ain't going away. You're absolutely right. We're going to have to live with HIV and AIDS for the unforeseeable future, and we need to be talking and preventing the spread of it. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.